Welcome to Farmed and Dangerous, a long-term memory radio series on the pharmaceutical industry in Canada. In this hour, we will be speaking to Barbara Mintzes of the Center for Health Services and Policy Research at the University of British Columbia. She's concerned about health risks and soaring costs linked to direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription medicines. In the second half, Ellen Reynolds of DES Action Canada brings us up to date on the ongoing cross-generational health effects of a hormone drug that was banned in Canada in the early 1970s.
We're speaking with Barbara Mintzes, health researcher at the Center for Health Services and Policy Research at University of British Columbia. How are you this afternoon?
I'm fine, thanks.
A study released in February of 2002 says that patients who go to the doctor and specifically request medication are 9 times more likely to walk out of the doctor's office with a prescription than those who don't. What would you like people to understand about direct-to-consumer drug advertising?
Well, the aim of drug advertising is to stimulate sales. It's not neutral information about a product. And because, you know, an ad for a prescription medicine is similar to an ad for Coca-Cola or type of computer or whatever, in that the manufacturer is trying to present their product in as positive a light as possible.
I see that there are studies of doctors prescribing in industrialized countries that show inappropriate prescribing leads to poorer health outcomes.
There certainly have been studies of the effects of doctors' reliance on drug promotion as compared to doctors who rely on more independent sources of information, and that there is a well-documented association between reliance on promotional information and less appropriate prescribing in terms of not prescribing the right drug for the right indication, the doses, the administration schedule, whether the least costly of equal alternatives is being prescribed, and combinations of different drugs. So there certainly are concerns about the effects of reliance on drug promotion on prescribing appropriateness.
There would seem to be a correlation between this kind of inappropriate prescribing and the high level of doctor-caused mortality rates in the Western world.
I don't know if you can say that. There haven't been any studies that have gone on to actually look in the long term to look at what the health effects are. And that's partially because that's very hard to study. I think it's more that if you look at how would medicines best be used, you know, in terms of having the best possible health outcomes and the least likelihood of harm from medicine use. And there are certainly some principles of appropriate prescribing. One of them is that you would not necessarily prescribe a newer drug, particularly if there wasn't any evidence that it was a real breakthrough compared to what's already on the market. And one of the concerns about drug promotion and advertising aimed at consumers especially is that it's pushing very, very rapid use of newer medicines before we know very much about their harmful effects, for instance, their less common harmful effects, and also before we know whether they really will prevent serious illness in the long term or disability or death. I mean, that's certainly a concern in terms of advertising really pushing the use of drugs before we know very much about them.
Perhaps we ought to start at the beginning in a sense. I feel like we've plunged into an issue that is in the middle somewhere.
Yeah.
First of all, what does direct-to-consumer advertising mean to you in terms of your interests?
I'm working on a PhD, actually, on research on direct-to-consumer advertising and looking at how it's affecting prescribing decisions in primary care, so when people go and visit their family doctor. And direct-to-consumer advertising is defined as it's television ads, radio ads, or magazine and newspaper ads for prescription drugs. And it's illegal in most countries in the world. There are actually 2 countries that allow this kind of advertising, the United States and New Zealand.
How would you describe your principal concerns around the issue of direct-to-consumer advertising?
I guess the principal concern, which is also the way that it's also embedded in our law. Direct-to-consumer advertising is against the law for health protection reasons. And that's because these are medical treatments. They're products that are capable of causing harmful as well as beneficial health effects. And the reason that a drug would be approved to use as a prescription-only drug is because generally either there are more harmful effects or there's less known about harmful effects because it's a very new drug. And generally these are products that treat more serious health conditions and they need to be used with the advice of a health professional. And because of that, manufacturers are forbidden from either selling the products directly to the public or advertising them directly. What we've seen, though, is in the U.S. and New Zealand, their laws on prescription medicines were silent about the target of advertising campaigns. They didn't actually pass laws to allow this kind of advertising. It just wasn't done until fairly recently in New Zealand. And in the U.S., the first print ad campaigns were in the early 1980s.
Now, of course, in Canada, we get American TV,
yeah,
American magazines. So how would you describe the limitations or the regulations in the Canadian context, knowing that we get this input?
Part of the advertising that we get from the U.S., there's nothing that we could do anything about. For instance, if there's a television station that's very close to the border and it's broadcasting and people can pick it up in Canada as well. So there's a certain amount where we just happen to be next to the U.S. border. When it comes to magazines that are sold in Canada or cable television that's broadcast for a Canadian audience, though, then we're looking at an enforcement issue because the Canadian government has decided that although these ads are illegal in Canada, they can be present in media that's reaching a Canadian audience. When it comes to magazines, it's very inconsistent. For instance, if it's a split-run magazine, so some of the magazines with a very large circulation in Canada, like Time or Newsweek, then it won't have the advertising that's illegal in Canada. If it has a smaller run, so there's just one North American version produced, like, say, Ladies' Home Journal, then it will have both illegal pharmaceutical and tobacco advertising. So it's a very sort of inconsistent approach. And what we've seen as well lately is a lot more made-in-Canada ads that are pushing the boundaries of the law and beyond, and that really there hasn't been much of a response in terms of enforcement from the Canadian government. I mean, you've probably seen the guy jumping around in the Viagra ad,
yes,
or, you know, the billboards that say, Zyban, ask your doctor. Those are prescription drug ads. If you look at the Food and Drugs Act, they're very clearly against the law. And yet we're seeing them, and we're really not seeing any kind of a regulatory response to prevent this kind of advertising.
Is this an example of a new trend in drug promotion? In other words, finding loopholes in existing regulations, and what other loopholes might be going on?
Actually, what we've seen is a redefinition of the law. In Health Canada policy documents, which are now defining something that was brought in 1978 to allow pharmacists to post comparative prices. And that's now been redefined as a loophole that would allow this kind of advertising, for instance, the Viagra ad or the Zyban billboard that I mentioned. These are a kind of direct-to-consumer ads that are called reminder ads in the pharmaceutical marketing literature. They mention the brand name of the product, but they don't mention what it's used for. And the clause that's been used now as a loophole to allow this kind of advertising is a clause that says that the advertiser may not make any representation other than name, price, and quantity of the drug. And it was brought in, you can actually read about it in Health Canada documents describing our laws. It was brought in 1978, and it was brought in to allow price advertising in pharmacy. That's a very different thing than the kind of Viagra ad on television or Zyban ads on television or Diane 35, a lot of products that we've seen advertised more recently, they contain quite a few other representations other than name, price, and quantity. I mean, they never mention, quote, price, but they also have an advertising image. They often have statements like, go ask your doctor. They are a type of ad that's trying to stimulate sales and get people to go into their doctor's office to ask for a specific product. And it's hard to see how that is in any way consistent either with the wording of the Food and Drugs Act or the actual reason that it prohibits direct-to-consumer advertising, which is a health protection measure that's aimed to avoid stimulating sales of prescription drugs.
Well, it seems to me that they are succeeding brilliantly at targeting consumers and getting them to buy their products. How is it that they succeed so well?
Certainly, there's a lot more exposure to advertising in the United States where it's legal than in Canada where it's not. You know, even though we're seeing these ads, the volume is very small compared to in the U.S. The U.S., in late 1999, a market research company estimated that with an average amount of TV viewing, people would see more than 9 prescription drug ads a day. The spending has gone up by more than a third since then. So, we can assume that the amount of ads that a person sees each day would be more than that. And that has a cumulative message as well as a message about every specific product. The message is, whatever the problem, you can always pop a pill. And the message is also one that, you thought you were healthy. Well, think again. You know, maybe you should be anxious that you'll have a health problem that you're not aware of. It's an educational message that isn't necessarily the best public health message in terms of what the actual health results would be.
Looking at questionable promotional practices, new pitches for old drugs, and creating diseases out of health risks, what is the focus of your current activities in terms of your activism or your research? Any new studies or results of conferences that you've come away with recently?
My main research on direct-to-consumer advertising consists of a survey in physicians' offices, in family doctors' offices, in Vancouver and in Sacramento, looking at how often people come into their doctor's office and request a prescription drug and how likely they are to get it if they request it, and also a measure of how confident or ambivalent the doctors were in the choice of treatment as compared to other drugs that they prescribed to other patients on the same day. What I found was that patients in Sacramento who were similar to the Vancouver patients were more than twice as likely to come into their doctor's office and request an advertised drug. In both places, if a person requested an advertised drug, they were highly likely to get it. About 3/4 of the time, they walked out of the office with a prescription for that specific product. And in general, they were much, much more likely to receive a prescription for something as compared to other patients who didn't come in and request an advertised drug. The other thing that I found is that doctors were much more likely to be ambivalent about those prescribing decisions when they prescribed a drug that a patient had requested as compared to other prescriptions that they provided. So about half the time, for instance, they said it was a possible or an unlikely treatment choice if they prescribed an advertised drug that a patient had requested, as compared to other prescriptions that a patient hadn't requested. Most of the times they said those were very likely treatment choices for other similar patients facing the same problem. So my concern out of that is that there are pressures on physicians to prescribe drugs that their patients request. And if you put that information together with the type of very partial information that you get in the advertising, where the ads will only tell you about one specific product, and they often use very emotional messages to give the impression, for instance, that it's very effective or that it's the best possible treatment for a particular condition, people aren't getting the kind of information they need to make those decisions. A, to know whether they actually have the health problem that the drug treats, and then whether it's the best possible treatment. So that's one area that I've been looking into.
There was an Ipsos Reid survey in February of 2002, which found that 68% of Canadians support direct-to-consumer advertising for prescription medicines because they believe it's educational.
Well, that was a survey that was commissioned by an advertising association, actually the Alliance for Access to Medical Information, which is a lobby group created by the advertising industry in order to push for direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs. One of the problems about the survey is that it didn't actually define what was meant by direct-to-consumer advertising, and it didn't define what the current law does or does not allow or give any of the reasons for why advertising is not allowed currently. The other side in looking at those results is that it is clear that people want information about prescription drugs. And, you know, I would support that entirely. The question is whether advertising can provide the kind of information that will actually help a person to make a decision about whether they need a medical treatment or not. You see, the thing about it is that the drug industry has an interest in allowing direct-to-consumer advertising in Canada. So does the advertising industry, because they see it as an increase in revenue to allow prescription drug advertising. This was actually paid for by the Alliance for Access to Medical Information, it calls itself, but it's an association of advertising industry companies, not drug industry.
The Alliance for Access to Medical Information?
Yeah. I think it's mainly advertising industry. And it's the drug industry is also pushing for direct-to-consumer advertising. And actually, the Canadian Association of Broadcasters have also lobbied members of Parliament about allowing direct-to-consumer advertising. If you look at it, you know, financially, both the pharmaceutical industry, the advertising industry, and media would see a benefit in opening up a type of advertising that hasn't been allowed in Canada before.
Apparently, you're mostly interested in promotion that targets consumers, people at home watching TV and reading magazines, and not necessarily prescribers or drug sellers. Is that correct?
No, I would be concerned as well about promotion aimed at physicians, especially. And part of the problem is in Canada, we don't regulate promotion very well. We mainly depend on the pharmaceutical industry to self-regulate. And that's true, for instance, for most forms of promotion that are aimed at doctors. The sales representatives who visit doctors and give them pitches promote newer drugs and then also leave free samples with physicians, sponsored meetings. There are a range of promotional activities that actually are completely unmonitored, and the only kind of enforcement of our regulations on drug promotion is if someone makes a complaint to the Pharmaceutical Industry Association. They will then investigate that complaint. And if the company is found guilty of a promotional violation, then they're fined between $5,000 and $15,000 per year. It's $5,000 for the first offense, going up to $15,000. They get a clean slate the next year. Those are very small fines for a major multinational pharmaceutical company, you know, as compared to the amount of money that they might be able to make by promoting increased sales.
In your opinion, how can both new and traditional forms of drug promotion be controlled in the interests of public health?
I would say that we need to have direct government regulation of drug promotion rather than depending on the industry to self-regulate, because that hasn't been shown to work. There's a conflict of interest. The other thing would be to look at whether, for example, it makes any sense to allow free samples of pharmaceuticals as compared to more extensive public pharmaceutical plans to make sure that actually needed medicines are covered. Because the problem with free samples is that it will push the use of new medicines simply because doctors have them in the office to give out as samples to their patients, when those aren't necessarily the product that a doctor would have chosen to prescribe. I can't see any rationale for Canada to change its laws to allow direct-to-consumer advertising. And actually, in today's issue of the Canadian Medical Association Journal, the CMA, the Canadian Medical Association, comes out very strongly against allowing direct-to-consumer advertising in Canada. I do think we have to look at whether, if we have a law on the books, if we have, in the Food and Drugs Act, we have limits on the activities that manufacturers can carry out to promote their products to the public for health protection reasons, shouldn't we actually be enforcing those laws?
How would you imagine that education about drugs, about medication, could take place? How can we get the information we need?
I think we definitely need more information than is easily available now. And what we need is independent comparative information. So that could be produced by consumer organizations together with health professional organizations, for instance. There are lots of models around of independent drug bulletins that provide information for physicians. For instance, the Therapeutics Initiative in British Columbia produces just a double-sided drug bulletin with information on how to treat specific conditions or information about what's known about the effects of specific drugs, often new drugs that a physician might be hearing a lot about through drug promotion. So what we need is, we need to finance production of information on medicines and on health conditions for the public as part of the healthcare system. That would probably more than pay for itself in that it would give people information about when treatments are and are not needed and would help to promote more appropriate care. So that's one thing. We have to separate that out from the pharmaceutical industry, which has an interest in promoting a specific type of treatment, and then specific companies have interests in promoting specific products. The other thing is that information should be integrated into the healthcare system and very easily available when people visit their family doctors, and also easily available through channels like public libraries and on the internet. And there is some information that's available, but it's certainly not, it's not universally available. So that's one side. The other side is that in Canada, we don't have the kind of information rights that all citizens of the European Union have right now in terms of getting written, approved product information with each prescription when it's dispensed. And that's a real gap in our healthcare system that would be very, very easy to fix. That's something that Health Canada has begun discussions on how to produce what they call the patient product monograph, which is just information that tells you what the drug is, how does it work, what's its approved use in Canada, what are the main side effects that people experience commonly, how often do they experience them, and then what are the more serious risks that you should watch out for, and what do you do if you have a harmful drug reaction. That type of information is not readily available, and it would be very easy to incorporate that so that it was provided with each prescription when it's dispensed. Pharmaceutical companies do have a specific interest. They have a function, and it's an important one, which is to produce medicines, and many of the medicines that are produced are very important and have made an important contribution to health. Where there ends up being a problem is where the market forces are pushing companies towards producing medicine for very minor health problems or for more cosmetic problems, where that isn't really where the public health needs are. The other side is that because to get a new drug approved in Canada, a company only has to show that it does, to some extent, have the claimed effect, so it can affect symptoms of depression, for instance, a bit better than placebo or placebo over sugar pill. What the company doesn't have to show is that their drug is any better than other treatments that are already on the market for the same problem. And that creates incentives in the industry to produce a lot of what are called me-too products, products that are very similar chemically to medicines that we already have and that don't necessarily provide any kind of advantage. And then, you know, companies also have to carve out market share. They have to heavily promote their products if they're going to recoup their investments on producing them. So there is a perverse incentive in the sense that there's the market forces that no matter how good a new drug it is, they have to sell the product. Whereas what we'd want to have from a more public health perspective is a situation where the market incentives would push companies to produce drugs, say, for instance, for diseases that aren't adequately treated, where there's a real health advantage. And that's a problem on a global scale. It's not just a problem in Canada. You know, one of the big problems globally is that there isn't a financial incentive for companies to produce treatments for important tropical diseases because those diseases occur in poor countries where people can't pay for treatments.
Returning just to the North American context, just for the last question, I remember that you told a story about a young woman who took a drug for bloating and who died. Was that related to direct-to-consumer advertising or the lack of access to information?
That was related to lack of access to information. That was Vanessa Young, who's the daughter of an ex-member of the provincial parliament in Ontario, and she had been prescribed a drug called Prepulsid, or its generic name was Cisapride, just months before it was removed from the market for safety reasons. The drug was approved for, I think, for nighttime heartburn. You know, as it was used, more and more post-market reports of safety concerns had come in. She was prescribed it for an unapproved use, and she and her family didn't receive any written information outlining what was known about the risks of the product. And there was a coroner's inquest after the case, after her death. She was a 15-year-old who, a terrible, tragic story, actually, who died after taking a drug that was for very minor problem, and neither she nor her family had any idea that they were taking something that was potentially so risky.
Right. But this is not connected to advertising. This is a drug safety issue.
It's connected to advertising in a sense, in that advertising pushes the use, it promotes the use of newer drugs, because when the drug is first approved for marketing, companies are under a very intense pressure to increase the sales of that drug. And if you're looking at medicine use from more of a public health perspective, then you would not be promoting very broad, widespread use of newer drugs when they're first marketed, because at that point we don't know very much about the effects of those drugs.
So the drug was most likely insufficiently tested?
Well, whenever a drug is first marketed, on average, say between 2,500 and 3,000 people will be exposed to a drug pre-marketing. After it's released for marketing, it might be taken by hundreds of thousands or millions of people. And so there is always information that it's impossible to know about a drug when it's first approved. A prudent use of new drugs would be to only use a newer drug, say one that's been approved within the last 5 years, if there isn't adequate treatment for the health condition you're trying to use, if it's a real breakthrough in treatment. For instance, when the first antiretroviral drugs for HIV/AIDS were first marketed, those were real advances in treatment, and there was an important reason that people should take them for a life-threatening disease. When it comes to taking, say, yet another new anti-inflammatory drug for arthritis, for instance, there is a good reason why taking a new drug wouldn't be the best approach, where it would make a lot more sense to go with the drugs that are more tried and true, where we have enough experience in enough people and different types of population groups to know that it's not likely to cause serious harm, or to know exactly what the harmful effects would, to know more about what the harmful effects are so that a person can watch out for symptoms. When it comes to taking very new drugs, there are a lot of questions still. And often new drugs will have only been tested for very short periods of time, like most antidepressants are tested for about 8 weeks in the pre-marketing trials. But once they're on the market, they're taken for months or years, and often we really don't have a good idea of what's happening in the long run in terms of health.
Health researcher Barbara Mintzes spoke to us from Vancouver.
Barbara Mintz's article entitled Blurring the Boundaries, New Trends in Drug Promotion is available on the Health Action International website at www.hiweb.org. Again, that's www.haiweb.org. For more information on misleading drug promotion and how it influences healthcare, try the Healthy Skepticism website at www.healthyskepticism.org. That's healthyskepticism.org.
DES Action Canada is the only consumer organization in the country alerting Canadians and health professionals to the ongoing risks related to the drug DES. Since 1982, this not-for-profit organization has worked to ensure that a medical mistake like that of DES never happens again. We welcome Ellen Reynolds of DES Action Canada. What health effects did DES exposure have on the women who took it? Why were they taking it, first of all?
DES, or diethylstilbestrol, is a synthetic estrogen. And it was prescribed to pregnant women in Canada between 1941 and 1971. It was in the mistaken belief to prevent miscarriage. And in fact, they discovered much later that it didn't prevent miscarriage and caused miscarriages in many cases. The long-term effects of DES were first seen in the sons and daughters of the women who took the drug. And those effects include DES daughters, those who were exposed in the womb, developing a rare form of vaginal cancer called clear cell adenocarcinoma. And these daughters also have an increased risk of miscarriage, premature delivery, and ectopic pregnancy, and other reproductive problems. The sons of the women who took DES may have fertility problems and a higher risk of developing testicular cancer. And the women themselves who were prescribed DES have an increased risk for developing breast cancer. So those are the general effects of the drug.
And how many people were affected?
In Canada, there are estimates, and we only have a rough number. The estimates are that between 200,000 and 400,000 women were prescribed DES in Canada.
Did any legal action ever take place?
No legal action has taken place, although in other countries it has. In France, for example, most recently, this summer, a case was decided in Nanterre, a suburb of Paris, where two DES daughters did, the court ruled in their favor, and the pharmaceutical distributor of DES in France, Pharmacia, had to provide compensation for these two DES daughters. But in Canada, no cases have come forward. One of the reasons for that is that DES was prescribed in this country under over 200 different names, and it was prescribed by many different pharmaceutical companies. And because of the length of time between when the drug was prescribed and when the effects were found, in a lot of cases, the statute of limitations limits the ability for women or men to come forward and to put a lawsuit together against the drug company. In a lot of cases, too, they don't know which drug company or distributed the particular drug that they took. So it's very difficult to have lawsuits, a successful lawsuit in Canada.
DES exposure may sometimes be viewed as not relevant or unique to those who were directly exposed. Is that true?
Well, in fact, it's not. Sometimes it has been referred to as a drug that is passé and that the effects are no longer being felt, but that's not correct. It's a very current public health issue. For example, the daughters of the women who were prescribed DES are now either they're still in childbearing years and maybe experiencing fertility problems, or they're approaching menopause, and DES specialists predict that they may be at higher risk for certain hormone-related cancers. General population, the DES population has been looked at by researchers over 30 years now as a so-called human effect model for the endocrine disruptors that we're seeing in the environment that are being caused by various forms of pollution.
Now, you mentioned endocrine disruptors. What sources do we have in our daily lives for endocrine disruption, and what is endocrine disruption?
What was discovered was that certain pollutions that are produced in the production of plastic, for example, dioxins and some of the most dangerous pollutants in our society, also have effects, besides being toxic, also have effects on the hormone system. And they are so-called endocrine disruptors or hormone disruptors. And DES, although it was actually developed specifically in a laboratory, is also a form of hormone disruptor. It's a synthetic estrogen. And that's how these endocrine disruptors operate in the environment and have very similar effects to the effect of this drug, DES, which is why the population of DES exposed is very important to look at for the effects of endocrine disruption for the general population.
Now, going back to the 70s again, DES was used to make food-producing animals grow faster. It was a growth hormone, and it was prohibited. But there's talk now that synthetic hormones such as DES are still being found in Canadian meat. Do you have any comment?
Yes, that's true. There was an audit done by the European Commission in the year 2000 of the Canadian system for testing for these medicinal residues and hormones in our food-producing animals and in our food. And what the audit found was that the testing mechanisms in Canada were inadequate, and they suggested that even meat that was stamped hormone-free in Canada could well contain medicinal residues or residues of medicines and hormones.
So hormones may still be injected or otherwise fed to food-producing animals.
Yes, and how that's happening, speculated anyway, is that DES is still prescribed as a veterinary drug, and it's not supposed to be used, as you mentioned, for food-producing animals, but in some cases, veterinary drugs are used for extra label, what's called extra label use. So they're used in other animals for a different purpose than they were indicated for. And this is what seems to be happening with DES. And there's currently a study going on at the moment through Health Canada to look into this extra label use of DES and other hormones.
Are you aware of any other synthetic hormones or other sources for synthetic hormones that people are being exposed to?
As I mentioned, the endocrine disruptors in the environment coming from, for example, dioxins, the production of plastics, and even the use of plastics in our home, which have been shown to leach chemicals which mimic hormones and act like synthetic estrogens. These are things that are in our own homes, producing effects that are similar to the effects of DES exposure.
And so we're talking about hormone-related cancers, for example, as a result of this exposure.
Yes, there's a lot of evidence that's showing that these hormone disruptors are causing an increase in hormone-related cancers. There are a lot of unknowns as well, though, because the scientific evidence is very difficult to pinpoint exactly what is causing which hormonal cancer. But what is known by the researchers is based on three main lines of evidence, and that includes the effects of DES exposure and looking at that population as a human effect model. And secondly, looking at wildlife effects, the effects of pollution on wildlife, and the increased levels of hormone-related cancers in wildlife. And thirdly, the effects on humans, looking at epidemiology and the increase in cancer rates, looking at infertility and things like the contamination of breast milk with dioxins.
And in that hall is a pallet bed. Sing May, Queen May, sing Mary. Tis stained with blood like ruby red. Sing, ah, good man for the newborn babe.
What the term environmental estrogen means?
An environmental estrogen is a pollutant that acts like a synthetic estrogen. It's a chemical such as dioxin and other chemicals that are produced by the process of manufacturing plastics and the burning of waste, for example. These endocrine disruptors are affecting the hormone system of wildlife and humans, similar to the effect of DES.
What role does the pharmaceutical industry play in all of this?
Well, regarding the DES example, the drug was developed in 1938, and by 1948 it was hailed as a wonder drug and was promoted to doctors as recommended for all pregnancies to ensure bigger and stronger babies, as well as to prevent miscarriage. The scientific evidence just wasn't there to support that. And by 1953, it had in fact been proven that DES was ineffective to prevent miscarriage, and it was unsafe in many cases. It was 18 years later that it was finally contraindicated for use in pregnancy. So for 18 years, the scientific evidence showed that DES was ineffective and unsafe, but it was continued to be promoted. And this is what we've seen with many drugs, many of these so-called wonder drugs and miracle drugs. We've seen just recently with the announcement about HRT in the news and the scientific evidence, which has finally come out to show that HRT, in fact, does more harm than good. DES was an early example of this sort of promotion of drugs before science.
These are all synthetic hormones.
Yes.
How profitable is it for the pharmaceutical industry to sell synthetic hormones?
Well, it's obviously very profitable because HRT, as an example, is one of the top-selling drugs in North America. And DES, as I mentioned, was the so-called wonder drug of its day. So they're very popular, very highly promoted, and they're only promoted because they are profitable.
Tell us about DES Action Canada. What do you consider to be your mandate?
DES Action Canada's mandate is to identify and support and advocate for people who've been exposed to the drug DES. And there are still many people out there, men and women, who are unaware of their exposure because the effects are so long-term and in some cases not readily evident. Only a small number of DES daughters, 1 in 1,000 DES daughters, actually develops the rare form of cancer that's associated with DES, but there are many other effects. And one of the things that's important right now as a current issue is that DES exposure needs to be, people who are DES exposed need to be monitored for the possible development of hormone-related cancers in the future. Because DES specialists have said that what happened with DES exposure in the womb is that that exposure predisposed those girls and boys to developing cancer later in life. This is why it's important for example, DES daughters to be monitored as they approach menopause and as their risk for certain types of cancers increases. It's also important to note that a lot of DES daughters who may not know that they've been exposed may also be seeking fertility treatments and or HRT, which are synthetic hormones. And DES specialists recommend that DES daughters avoid any further exposure to synthetic hormones. So it's very important to identify who's been exposed and to try to avoid further exposure.
Is there any other comment you'd like to make before we let you go?
One other issue for DES and bringing it into the current day as well is that recent research has been showing that there may be third-generation effects of DES exposure. So the grandsons and granddaughters of the women who prescribed DES may have increased risk for developing cancer in the reproductive system.
Since he was born, it blooms and blows. Sing falcon songs for the newborn babe.
There's a two-part thrust to DES exposure. One is the women who took it when they were pregnant, and another is the general Canadian population who are possibly getting it, in meat products.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's something that Health Canada has just started a study into, the extra-label use of DES.
How can people get in touch with you?
Well, DES Action Canada has a website, and we have an office in Montreal. The toll-free number is 1-800-482-1-DES. 1-800-482-1-DES. And our website is hosted at www.web.net, www.web.net, or you can search google.com and put the search in DES Action Canada to have a look at our website.
Ellen Reynolds of DES Action Canada was speaking to us from her home in Victoria, BC.
Contact information for DES Action Canada is 1-800-482-1-DES. Again, the number is 1-800-482-1-DES. And for the DES Action Canada website, go to any good search engine and type in DES Action Canada. Next week, Farmed and Dangerous looks at the marketing of depression. Our guest is David Healy, psychiatrist and much published expert in drugs related to mood and brain function. David Healy made headlines across North America in November 2000 when the University of Toronto rescinded a high-profile job offer over his criticism of the antidepressant Prozac. Farmed and Dangerous will feature a special one-hour conversation with David Healy. Our sincere thanks to Barbara Mintzes and to Ellen Reynolds.
Farmed and Dangerous is produced by the Community News Collective at CKUT Radio McGill as part of its award-winning long-term memory radio series. Our thanks to all of those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. Stay tuned for long-term memory radio each and every Wednesday at 5 p.m. on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on Real Audio on the World Wide Web at www.ckut.ca. This 10-part Farmed and Dangerous series is available in a set of CDs from Radio McGill. For more information, please give us a call at area code 514-398-6788 or visit our website at www.ckut.ca and click on Community News. This is Long-Term Memory Radio.
Things we turned away.